Great evening. I love hearing all the chatter because we haven't been face to face for a while. But we'll go ahead and get our meeting started. I want to welcome everybody to the, what month is this, April? FAP meeting. And it's good to be back. I'm sorry I missed everything in January, February, and March, but I'm back and ready to catch up. So we'll go ahead and get started with roll call. And our icebreaker tonight is, what do you look forward most about spring? And let's see, I don't see Ashley here. Chad Williams?
Yep, here.
Yes.
Actual vitamin D.
Vitamin D, absolutely. Elma?
I'm here. Planting fruits and vegetables.
Okay, getting those things ready. Great. Emily?
It's open all year now, but I love when the farmer's market comes back. Mm-hmm. We like to walk down there.
Mm-hmm. Franklin Johnson? Dr. Bishop?
I like to go on scenic drives, and so it's the time of the year when you can finally get out and reliably and not crash your car.
Dr. Dauphin? Dr. Charles? Laura Schott? Thank you.
I
couldn't see that you were chewing.
Seems like a small thing. I live in kind of a cold little house, and so I love being able to open the windows now.
Yeah, nice. Laura.
I kind of wanted to move the meeting outside because I love days like this. So next time, maybe? No.
Maybe. When we do it virtually, you can take your computer out.
Oh, yeah.
Picnic day, do that. Mark Collier. Marla?
Let's see. I would say gardening. We just moved, so we went from 3 acres to a really little tiny gardening place. So I'm going to learn how to do that. Mm-hmm.
Great. All right. I think the thing I'm looking forward to is the longer days and spring flowers. Mm-hmm. Tracy Fernandez.
So, the sun, the pretty trees, and not panicking when I get my gas bill.
Tyler.
I just love looking forward to the longer days so I can spend more time outside. Okay.
Counselor Fuentes.
You need to have coffee outside, outdoors in the morning. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Might be a little chilly still, but it's not raining.
Mm-hmm. A little jacket that helps.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Counselor Young, I don't see. Dr. Millman.
The end of respiratory illness season. Can't resist.
You're in the right job.
Andrew Proof.
I would have to say spring baseball season. Mm-hmm. For my son.
Jeff Robinson.
Longer days, being able to golf without freezing.
Okay. And Dr. Brianna de Silvia Battia. I've been practicing it so much.
Gardening. Definitely gardening.
Okay. Great. Did I miss anybody?
Jerry?
I'll go.
Oh, sorry.
No problem. I love the smell of freshly cut grass in the spring.
Yeah, all right. Great. All righty. Everyone should have gotten a copy of the minutes, and hopefully you had a chance to read them from the last meeting. And do you have any changes, amendments, corrections? If not, do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
I need to approve the minutes.
Okay. I have a moment. A second. Everyone in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? The minutes have been approved. Dr. Melnick, do you want to do an update on our recruiting for the deputy director?
Yes, we've successfully recruited a deputy director for our health department. Her name is Danette York. She starts on May 1st, and just a little bit of a background on her. I actually known her From 2009 to 2019, she was a public health director for Lewis County. And she was very active in the Washington State Association of Local Public Health Officials at the time. And then she took a job in California as director of the Butte County Health Department. And she actually has over 200 employees and a budget bigger than ours here. So she did that from 2019 to 2024, so she's well experienced in public health administration. She's got a bachelor's degree in organizational leadership from Northern Kentucky University and a master's in public health from Ohio State. And she's also, she's been a lecturer at California State University in Chico in environmental health. So she's got some environmental health background as well. So she starts May 1st. I'm really thrilled.
Great.
I'll bring her to, she'll obviously come to a back meeting, so.
Great. All right. Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
All right. Mallory, do we have anybody from, I don't see anybody, but.
No one from the public is here.
Okay. All right.
Surprising.
All right. At this point, I'd like to introduce Andrea, and she's going to do a presentation for us around the access to prenatal care.
Yes. Thank you so much. I'm going to wait for Mallory to tee it up. Okay. Thank you so much. Well, good evening, everyone. My name is Andrea Pruitt. I serve as the Community Health Director here at Clark County Public Health. I am presenting on behalf of an interdisciplinary team of Clark County Public Health staff this evening, who are responsible for the research, the data collection, the policy analysis that's included in the following presentation materials. So I just want to offer up my gratitude and a huge thank you to Adiba Ali, who is one of our epidemiologists on our health assessment and evaluation team, Emma Burkhart, who is a nurse home visitor in our nurse family partnership program, and Haley Pickus, who is our family initiatives coordinator with our Life Course program. So this cohort will provide this presentation to our Board of Health tomorrow and engage in a discussion about prenatal access to care among Clark County residents with Medicaid health insurance coverage. The Medicaid program in Washington State is also referred to as Apple Health, so in the event you hear those terms used interchangeably this evening throughout this presentation, please know that they reference the same funding source and type of insurance coverage. Next slide, please. So our presentation objectives for this evening include working to describe the public health importance of prenatal care and how accessing high quality, timely health care during pregnancy impacts health and health outcomes across the life course. We will review prenatal care population data and share a brief story from the field about experiences of community members trying to access care. And then we'll wrap up by identifying opportunities for our Board of Health members and you all as FAC to support our department and community's work on this ongoing issue. We do continue to hear from pregnant individuals in community and those who are providing services that accessing prenatal care with Apple Health coverage is difficult and oftentimes impossible. This can be extremely harmful to both the fetus and the pregnant person and will require joint concerted efforts to solve this problem in the short and the long term. Next slide, please. So prenatal care is the care that someone receives when they're pregnant. Comprehensive prenatal care may be delivered by a number of different types of providers, including family practice physicians or nurse practitioners, midwives or certified nurse midwives, obstetricians, and or maternal fetal medicine specialists. Routine prenatal care is a valuable opportunity for health counseling, as well as support for identifying and treating any complications as a result of pregnancy, infection, and or chronic disease. Comprehensive prenatal case management may also include and support medically or socially high-risk pregnant individuals in finding and accessing tailored services and supports, which include care coordination, health education, support with smoking cessation programs, and also supporting in circumstances of intimate partner violence, among other health-related needs. These investments
in early in life help us maximize and reap the health benefits throughout adulthood and often into the next generation. Early and regular prenatal care helps to promote healthy pregnancy and is associated with fewer preterm births, higher birth weight infants, fewer maternal and infant deaths, and inadequate care conversely increases the risk for pregnancy complications and adverse birth outcomes for the pregnant individual and for the baby. Put simply, high quality prenatal care places newborns on a trajectory for health and well-being and sets up families for early success. Regular high quality prenatal care also has a substantial economic value through reduced healthcare costs, increased education gains, and improved overall productivity. A 2017 study requested by the legislature and produced by the Washington State Institute for Public Policy estimates for every dollar invested in Medicaid-enhanced prenatal care programs could produce savings of $15.42 in the state of Washington. So when you're thinking about the economic and social returns on investments across this continuum, it's demonstrated that I think of all of the evidence-based programs, access to prenatal care and the delivery of that care is incredibly critical for the well-being of our community. And so this is why we should all be paying attention to what is happening in our community with respect to pregnant individuals who are seeking prenatal care, whether you're directly impacted, whether you're planning to raise children here or not. Our Medicaid services are funded through taxpayer dollars, and these investments should ensure that people with coverage are guaranteed high quality, cost effective, preventive health care. And we know that prenatal care is a smart investment. So unfortunately, even individuals with comprehensive pregnancy coverage through Apple Health are struggling to access care during this critical developmental window. So we're going to start by taking a look at some data. And we're going to use 2023 as our cohort reference here. And so in 2023, there were 5,484 births among Clark County residents. And on average, there are about 5,500 births every year. Next slide, please. Okay. So this chart breaks down all 2023 Clark County births by insurance type for each identified racial and ethnic group. The orange section of the bars show the percentage of birth in each racial group that are covered by Medicaid, where you need to qualify by income. And for pregnant individuals, that means having 210% or less of the federal poverty level. And the teal bars show a percent of each race group financed through private health insurance, and that would be typically employer-based insurance coverage and or individuals who are procuring health insurance on the marketplace. Less than 5% of birth in the light green bars had some other form of payment source, such as self-pay or military health plan or charity. The highest rates of Medicaid coverage were among birthing parents who identify as Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander, Hispanic, American Indian, Alaskan Native, and Black. These births all had a higher than average rate of Medicare coverage compared to the countywide average, which is 38%. So you can see that over there from the right. So it's important to note that these data represent percentages within each racial group, and the majority of Medicaid births were among white birthing parents, so 1,609 births, followed by Hispanic and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander pregnant individuals with 168 Medicaid births. The percentages in this chart illustrate that some communities have to over-rely on Medicaid for healthcare coverage. Next slide, please. So now that we have reviewed some of the baseline data and statistics on birth and health insurance coverage, we'll talk about how we measure how well pregnant people can access prenatal care. Data that is collected on birth certificate forms, besides collecting available demographic information about birth parents and baby,
also includes information fields on when pregnancy care began and the number of prenatal care visits that occurred during the pregnancy. This information is filled out by birth facility staff, and from these fields, our epidemiologists can calculate what is referred to as the adequacy of prenatal care utilization index, which was developed by maternal child health researchers and has been used in the field for decades as a measure to understand both the timing and completeness of the recommended schedule of prenatal care received by pregnant people. And so today we will be reviewing data describing births meeting criteria for inadequate prenatal care, which can be defined by two sub-criteria. So either care beginning in the fifth month of a pregnancy or later, or patients receiving less than 80% of recommended prenatal visits from the time care was initiated. And these sub-criteria and the baseline measure are based on current American College of Obstetrician and Gynecologist standards for schedules of prenatal care, which have evolved over time. So in 2023 in Clark County, 27% of all births, regardless of payer type, qualified as receiving inadequate care. So that's more than one in four individuals struggle to get access to timely prenatal care. And this represents 1,287 births. So we would not be good public health professionals if we didn't acknowledge some of the limitations and the challenges with this data set, as about 15% of all of our birth records are missing information about prenatal care initiation and the frequency of completed visits. This represents about 800 births in 2023 where we don't have information about how our community members who are pregnant and delivering babies fare. So what we're hearing from our Department of Health colleagues who manage the state database that houses this birth certificate data is that there was a substantial strain on hospitals during the pandemic, and we know this globally and just from our lived experience. And there are challenges that persist in terms of staff turnover, training that contribute to these breaks in data collection, and differences in gaps in terms of filling out that form and its completion. Also, those two fields on the birth certificate filing form are optional. They're not required. So we are in the very early stages of partnering with some of our local hospital practitioners who are working in OBGYN services to address the different opportunities to support strategies for filling out these fields at the point of care. So the more information we have, the more accurately we can describe opportunities to correct for areas where inadequate prenatal care may be existing in and on behalf of different populations, some more than others. So there's 15% of the data that is missing overall, but that data is not equally experienced across racial groups. 20% of American Indian Alaska Native community members have missing data fields on their birth certificates, and 26% of Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander community members have these fields absent on their birth certificates. And so here are the rates of inadequate care for the 2017 to 2023 period, broken down by insurance type. And so Medicaid births, shown in orange, have consistently had higher rates of inadequate care, meaning that they're less likely to get into care in a timely manner. The trend line converges in the years leading up to the pandemic, and possibly because pregnant people were utilizing less in-person care during that time period, you see those trend lines start to get closer together and merge. And so we see the historical trend start to reestablish itself in 2022. And by 2023, we see a reemergence of the post-pandemic baseline with the rates of inadequate care increasing for Medicaid members and declining for privately insured births. As of 2023, there was a 10 percentage point difference for inadequate care rates accessed by payer type. Next slide. When we disaggregate the data further, we find that inadequate care varies both by race and ethnicity and insurance type. These bars show the percent of each racial group with Medicaid health care coverage receiving inadequate care. Among Medicaid births, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander, Asian, and American Indian and Alaskan Native birthing persons have the highest rates of inadequate care compared to the county average, and the bar representing all groups combined at 33%. So for example, 65% of our Pacific Islander births with Medicaid had inadequate care, which is twice as high as the countywide Medicaid average for all racial groups combined. Next slide, please. When we look at the breakdown of differences in inadequate care by race, and comparing Medicaid to private health insurance side by side, we start to see different patterns emerge, where there are a larger share of Medicaid births in orange that are receiving inadequate care compared to privately insured births in teal. So gaps by race and ethnicity are wider for Medicaid-covered births, and we see again our Pacific Islander, Asian, and Native American births are more likely to receive inadequate care compared to those with private health insurance. Next slide, please. So the birth certificate data show us that there is gaps in care across the county, and critically, these access issues are not experienced equally. The Family Initiatives work within our Community Health Division is driven by community identified need. You can find the detailed issue briefs highlighting the voices and the experiences of families on topics that were elevated during our Raising Clark County data collection efforts, which initiated in 2021 on our public health website. And this also includes all of the resources in this presentation and our prenatal access to care issue brief, which also arose out of feedback from our community members. When we were alerted in late 2023 by our WIC partners, so this Women, Infant, and Children Nutrition Program, which is currently administered locally by CMAR here, that WIC clients could not access prenatal care appointments. And keep in mind that CMAR at the time and currently also has obstetric services embedded within their clinic. And so after contacting additional local providers and talking with our public health and nurse home visitors to get a better understanding of the potential scale and magnitude of the issue, public health elevated the concern to our maternal child health partners at the Washington State Healthcare Authority and also our colleagues at the State Department of Health. And we've been engaging in efforts to try to document and observe and define the ongoing access gaps, including areas for improvement in data collection and analysis ever since. In February 2024, we issued a press release with guidance and support and in partnership with the healthcare authority for Apple Health beneficiaries who were struggling to access prenatal care at the time, hoping to elevate the issue and really get people connected to their payers in order to be able to try to find access to providers to initiate prenatal care. In addition, local partners have started to track the availability within community of access to appointments for prenatal care. But despite these efforts, we continue to hear from our community partners, providers, and our nurse home visitors that the access to care issues persist and are compounding access gaps and include some loss of prenatal care providers in the community as of recently. Next slide, please. And so to try to bring home the experience of what it's like as a pregnant individual with Medicaid health insurance, earlier this year, one of our nurse home visitors, Emma Bernhardt, received a referral from a community partner connecting a first time or primiparous mom to our NFP program. The referring clinic provided pregnancy confirmation services but didn't offer prenatal care. And during the nurse home visitor's initial outreach to the referred individual, she informed the nurse that the referring clinic had sent her to us so we could help her find access to care. At the time that you spoke, the client was in the middle of her second trimester and had not yet been seen by a provider. The pregnant woman articulated to the nurse that she'd been trying to find a doctor, but that she'd been turned away from everywhere she had tried to call because her due date was considered too soon and there weren't any available providers. At that time, her due date was more than 4.5 months away, with ample opportunity for accessing the remainder of the recommended prenatal schedule of care prior to her due date. Although she had already called several clinics offering prenatal care services to pregnant individuals with Medicaid health insurance, our nurse home visitor asked if she'd like to try calling again together, and the individual agreed. So together they started off by calling an OBGYN specialty clinic embedded in one of our healthcare systems, which in this circumstance also included engaging an interpreter. So the three of them initiated outreach, and the nurse home visitor, Emma, the interpreter, and the prospective client and the referred pregnant individual spent about 45 minutes on the phone, mostly on hold, waiting to speak with a representative to see if she would qualify to be paired with a provider. When she was finally able to connect with clinic staff, they asked her a series of complex questions about, and some of which the client did not know how to answer, which included on where she was planning on delivering, if she had verified her delivery plans with her insurance in advance, and she didn't understand what that meant. And she just said that she was planning on delivering in Vancouver. And so the staff had asked her to call her health plan back and then call them back once she verified that her insurance would allow her to deliver at the hospital. And knowing that the organization would accept her Medicaid, the nurse asked them to bypass that question, which they had agreed to. And so in processing this experience, we as a team tried to imagine what that phone call would have been like if Emma hadn't been on the phone. If she hadn't had that nurse paired with her during that experience, that pregnant individual would have likely had to call the healthcare authority back, confirm that indeed she would and did have coverage to deliver at that hospital system, and then try to call back and wait for another 45 minutes to confirm and try to access care. Inevitably, that day and that exchange didn't result in that individual providing or accessing prenatal care. Emma asked her if she could try again on another day and see if there, like, what care existed in community, and that she would call her back if she found any provider willing to take her based on everything that Emma knew about the client. She spent several hours on another workday calling around to every prenatal care provider in our community, and one clinic had the capacity to take her and accept her as a new patient. And the caveat is that the clinic was in Longview. So at the time, and still currently, there is such limited access that the only place that this person could find the ability to access prenatal care was well beyond her capacity and transportation ability in north of us for a health system in Longview. And they were incredible. That is a health system where they said, we're not gonna turn anyone away, but when you start having to seek care right north of the county you live in, that's a good indicator that something isn't adding up. So knowing that this complexity exists, it's so critical to ground in what can we do about it, because I think our taxpayer dollars all are investing into the system, and the system is designed to be able to provide a baseline level of care. So in the circumstances where those agreements don't match, or there's tension somewhere and there are repeat issues with accessing those services, it elicits a series of questions about what's driving these issues and what can we collectively do to correct it. So next slide, please. So one of the common threads between the data that we've reviewed this evening and the experience I just shared with you about Emma and that referred client was that the pregnant community members trying to access prenatal care support
is that individuals who are struggling to provide to access prenatal care are typically insured by Apple Health. And so this slide is a simplified flowchart and graphic of our current Medicaid delivery system in the state of Washington. Our Medicaid agency is the healthcare authority. And Apple Health uses two primary models to finance healthcare coverage in Washington, a fee-for-service model on the left in purple, and a managed model on the right in teal. And at this point in time, we have received reports that clients enrolled in both care delivery models have voiced struggles accessing appointments for prenatal care. This can indicate issues with network adequacy and also insufficient reimbursement rates for provider groups who have historically provided care for this episode of care. So the key takeaway that I hope that this group considers is that there are levers federally and at the state level by which we can improve the way Medicaid care coverage is managed, delivered, and financed. We can and we should request more transparent and accountable systems to support our communities accessing care here in Clark County. And while we're discussing access to prenatal care this evening, there are many Medicaid-covered services that our insured community members are also struggling to access, including behavioral health care, specialty health care for children and youth with complex health care needs, and dental care, and more. So it's important to note that disparate rates of access to prenatal care among racial and ethnic groups point to additional system barriers beyond insurance and payer type, in addition to language barriers commonly encountered by our community members as part of their interactions. Our culturally specific community partners share examples of biased clinical care provider populations that do not consistently reflect their county's diversity. Transportation barriers and social and cultural norms that are not reflected or considered as part of our healthcare model. And we cannot discount these drivers' contributions in compounding access to care barriers as we work on overall system reform. Next slide, please. So the good news is there's a lot that we can do to improve the quality and the timeliness and the frequency of care. The life course and the health assessment and evaluation team recently completed a data and policy brief for prenatal access to care that includes the information in this presentation and additional research. The brief is published on our website on both our health assessment and evaluation and our recent Clark County web pages. The policy section of the published brief documents recommendations from several key state and federal assessments, as well as a federal blueprint that was completed during the Biden administration to address the maternal health crisis. And these recommendations are organized by sector and by rural, and also include areas for local public health engagement. On this slide, you'll see a high-level snapshot of some of our local progress in these areas to date, in addition to our ongoing work to improve data collection, data quality, and data use. We look forward to working with our hospital systems to improve data completeness with respect to completing and filing birth certificate forms. So this slide deck is the same slide deck we'll use tomorrow for our Board of Health presentation, but I think that this is a role and an invitation that also extends to FAC in your advisory capacity to the Board of Health. But here's the brief includes several recommendations by sector and by role, and there's a specific carve out for elected officials and policymakers. And so in addition to those recommendations outlined in the brief, this slide offers additional opportunities to support improving the quality of prenatal access to care in your FAC advisory role to Board of Health. And notably, this includes requesting a roundtable convening with our state and federal elected officials and system health system partners to prioritize and mobilize recommendations. Requesting a state legislative commission that's tasked with compiling a report on maternal health care access within the Medicaid population, Because keep in mind, I want you to remember that $1 investment to the $14.57 return, right? So this is an economic issue, it's a social issue, it's a health issue. And so we want to make sure that we have a good understanding of how our revenues are being invested and what we're getting for the return. So we're paying for it, but we're not getting the return, right? Because the return is predicated on access and the presumption that you receive high quality care. So keeping that in mind, having a third party commission do some of this analysis to get right to the core issues will be so critical for us to really steward our financial resources appropriately. The Board of Health could also adopt a healthcare access as a policy priority area and during the 2026 state legislative cycle, and then support any future state legislation, including budget actions and governor actions that preserve or expand access to care for Medicaid clients. Advocacy for implementation of federal rules that are aimed at enhancing accountability and transparency for Medicaid access and quality are also a really easy drawdown. The rules have been set, we just need to move to adoption. And locally, we can also encourage directing appropriate local funding towards initiatives that aim to improve access, quality, and cultural congruency for prenatal care and maternal health. Just different funding initiatives have different rules around expenditures, so those rules and conditions we clearly need to apply. So, next slide. That was a lot packed into a pretty complex topic. So we wanted to give you an overview and outline of the data, what we know, what we don't know, and recommendations for action and mobilization. And so with that, I'm happy to take any questions, and anything that I can't answer or Dr. Melnick can't answer, then we can definitely endeavor to go find more information and bring it back to this group.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
Is there data that shows for all the prenatal care providers in Clark County how many of them accept, is it Apple Health,
yeah,
and how many of them accept private, and like, is there a large gap between the two?
That's a great question, and there are various publicly available data sets that start to get to what you're describing, but there is not full transparency. So what you're referring to is like payer mix.
Right,
yeah.
Because
yeah.
I do feel like I am personally a consumer of private insurance, and this is definitely an issue. It seems like this is a systemic issue as a whole for all. And then also my follow-up question.
Before you ask a follow-up question,
yeah.
I just want to, so when you say accept, so you can accept Apple Health
yeah.
as a provider or private insurance,
yeah.
that doesn't mean that somebody is going to be able to get in for a visit. It could still, you accept, but the next available appointment could be 6 months down the line.
Right.
So it's
yeah.
not just about accepting, it's also about what, you know, the capacity and when they're going to see you. So
yeah, and part of the, when I was looking at the feedback on, like, but it's a lot of times is people just recently moved to Clark County. They haven't established care with a provider in general. And, you know, pregnancy is one of those things that has a timeline, whereas
mm-hmm.
I think everything else is like, unless you're sick, there's no timeline to it. And so what I'm asking is, I guess, does the issue lie upon just a lack of providers in Clark County as a whole, or is it something else, I guess?
Yes.
Yes, both.
Yes. So, Tracy, how
yeah.
would you answer that question
yeah.
from your perspective?
Oh, definitely.
Is it both and? Lack of providers and payer mix, or would you just say provider shortage is, like, from your experience, the primary driver?
Provider shortage is the primary driver. We not even enough providers. Like, let's just say you don't accept Apple Health. I'm not pissed off. We accept all, but there's not even enough providers to take care of your own
mm-hmm.
insured people. We woeful lack of OB providers in this, I think it's a countrywide, a national crisis for OB providers. I don't know if they decided they don't want to do it anymore. But so that's a huge issue. So you have to be able to recruit and attract providers to your county, which takes money. And we recently, we have three new OBs coming to our medical group, which will help, but that's not, it's an issue with providers. I mean, in Longview, which I'm surprised they had room, because it's OB, they happen to have enough, but primary care, it's an issue with primary care too. You can't even get to a primary care provider for 6 months. It's an issue.
But there's an underlying reason for that that has to do with economics and reimbursement.
Yeah, right.
So a lot of providers lose money on Apple Health.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yes, and there is also an obligation. So it, can you go back to the slide that has the graphic about the two type, the two payer models for, Okay, so fee-for-service on the left is a little bit more direct, but for the purposes of managed care contracts, and so the healthcare authority can either reimburse providers directly for covered services or provider groups, or that they can contract and hand over the responsibility for that to a managed care organization, and they receive per member, per month capitated rates for all of their enrolled beneficiaries. And so with that responsibility and that upfront payment for all of their enrolled members, they have a set of deliverables they're supposed to meet. And so to try to get to answer your question about, like, can you see how many providers can take this many clients, and you could do the math and you could just adjust it. We can't see those. So it's called network adequacy. So among other duties, managed care organizations are responsible for establishing their networks and finding providers that fit the criteria to meet their beneficiaries' needs. And then they have to keep that updated.
Yeah.
And so the healthcare authority manages the direct contract with the managed care provider or organization, but then everything negotiated in contract with providers south of that, the healthcare authority does not see either. And so they can put together their network. Let's just say we're just talking about a network for prenatal care providers. There's an algorithm and there's a set of criteria you have to meet. Is that the right criteria? Mm-hmm. Is it sufficient? It's a great question. Let's explore that, because data is telling us maybe not, but we're paying for it. That's what I want this group to think critically about. You're paying, we're all paying for this service that promotes health and well-being and better economic and community engagement, but we're not getting the return on the investment. So the money's going out the door, and so they're establishing a network, but there's a substantial difference that's bearing out in the data that they're still not getting care. So something's broken. So but what is that thing?
So the managed care organizations get a payment per month from their members, whether their members get seen or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's what capitation is all about.
But I can tell you that most of the MCO contractors with contracting with providers is fee for service. And so the provider ends up eating the cost of all the lost time with this population, because the no-show rates are quite high. So the payer, the Molinas of the world, are getting capitated rates, and then they're only doing fee for service to the providers,
right.
And that's what creates a gap. It's because I have to pay that provider for their whole 8 hours, but in all the lost time, we have to make up for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're identifying the gap, and that's where the MCOs aren't being required to pass on a capitated model.
Yes.
Right.
And over time, it becomes unsustainable for providers to
right,
accept. Like the requisite mix of privately insured individuals and Medicaid insured individuals because it's referred to commonly as like a death spiral. You'll put yourself out of business, and we're seeing that in clinics. You can't pencil it out.
Yeah, and my follow-up was like, I can't, like the Pacific Islander demographic, there must be some correlation with maybe the providers that can absorb it. They don't like to go see those providers for some reason or another, you know, like maybe they prefer to go see a midwife. Midwife places can't absorb those costs, so therefore they're like, well, we don't have adequate care,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I mean, I think there's a lot of layers with this.
You were absolutely correct.
Because the Pacific Islander on the bar chart is very, like, it's stuck out a lot.
The whole idea of managed care, though, is to manage the care for your members. But as you're hearing here, the members are left to their own accord for managing their care and calling around. And the providers are bearing the risk, if that makes sense.
Yes.
As are the covered members. And so there's this compression that happens downstream. So, yeah, healthcare systems, providers, beneficiaries, and the community. Because then what happens, and this is a layer that's not added to this flow chart, but the need still exists to try to coordinate access to care. So then what do? We use other mechanisms to try to offset the harm. And so then you're still investing more resource, but you can't quite get, right, what that standard of care needs to be. And so there's a pretty big break. But key to this, to understand where to invest the corrective strategies, is to have better transparency into those contracts that are negotiated with managed care organizations and provider groups, so then you can say, oh, here's where the issue is happening. This is fixable. And there are a series of value-based payment strategies that we can draw down on. Different states have varying degrees of success, but it's an incredibly inelastic market with little to no transparency, and that is by design. So 4 out of our 5 managed care organizations in the state of Washington are private for-profit entities. And so these systems, by design, the primary driver and mechanism is profit. And so when you have that as a driver, and then you add on layers of opacity, it becomes more and more challenging to get to the core service deliverable, which is providing high quality, appropriate, like triple aim level care, where you're focusing on prevention rather than downstream, right, health interventions across the beneficiary group.
I am in that data, in 2022, and not having been able to access a provider until my 4th month of pregnancy with twins. And I have 10 years of experience helping connect people to healthcare services. I've worked for Share, I've worked for Catholic, and I have been on that phone call where they're asking absolutely insane questions, like, I don't know where I'm gonna give birth yet, I don't have a doctor yet. And having to have me go back and forth, and I have a bachelor's degree, and, you know, the experience that I should be able to access that really easily, and for me to not be able to is like, yeah. So, I'm present in those numbers.
I think a lot of us in this room are represented somewhere in this space. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm a little bit distanced from my experience with Medicare and sort of the way that has been managed for our country. But there, and I think this still exists, but there were requirements on organizations and providers of care to report their data, which then would be available online for everyone to see. You can go look for yourself. How they're doing on things like getting aspirin on arrival to an ER for heart attack, and list of all kinds of things. And most of which, my memory is that was associated with older adult care, because that's where there was a lot of care going on. And it wasn't focused very much on children and babies, as I recall. However, that had a pretty big impact on the public as far as being able to become more knowledgeable about what does it look like to be a provider that's doing best practice in these various areas. So I could then, you know, look and say, well, how's my doctor's practice doing on those things? It's just a measure. It's not everything, but it is a metric that you can use to say, well, in this arena, they're functioning really well or maybe not so good. Is there anything like that that could help people to become, if the consumers become more knowledgeable, mm-hmm. it does usually make a difference to the providers as well?
I would agree, and I would say a balanced budget act of 1997, which removed caps for private for-profit managed care organizations, capacity to consolidate markets and made it more desirable to enter the health plan space of both Medicare and Medicaid. And so you're right. So it doesn't. So this same issue impacts individuals with Medicare Advantage. So our aging community is going to have these exact same issues, just with a different care access issue. So over the past several decades, we've seen a consolidation of the market, and so while reports exist of quality that plans provide, the measures are proxies, and there are different ways to game getting to compliance and getting value-based payments. So you can look great on paper, right? Has anybody in this room like ever interviewed anybody that looks great on paper and you're like, that didn't pan out? You've been that person or like had that. It's similar in concept. Just using the network adequacy, which is you have to have so many providers within a geographic region to be able to serve different members by specialty. Like two providers within a 10-mile radius of each other by X number of covered beneficiaries within your network.
Hey, Marla, I'm just also wondering about some of those measures in terms of provider measures are contingent on the provider having a relationship with the patient and seeing the patient. But if the patient never gets access to the provider, I mean, what we're talking about here is no care or not getting in the first place. So I mean, it depends on the measure that you're using.
And I
just looked at some of the measures that Andrea just mentioned about the prenatal adequacy in terms of supply. The measure was, I think, two providers within 10 miles.
Yeah.
And when we think about, we've got one, four thousand births a year to 3,000 births a year to the Medicaid population. To think about having two providers within 10 miles, just thinking about that, some of those measures are kind of interesting. But a lot of the provider measures and how you're practicing is based on you actually encountering the patient and seeing them in the office.
And they did reflect on the organization also. It wasn't necessarily just targeting the provider, but it actually looked at some of them on the system of care that surrounded that particular metric. So.
But those are for larger healthcare systems that have negotiating and purchasing power when negotiating rates with plans, right? And so varying degrees of quality measures by the system, by the provider versus what the plan can give you, right? I think our emphasis here, we're operating on the assumption that the care being provided, if right. you can get in, is good, yeah. right? That's not our issue, right? We're not receiving complaints that I received poor care. We're receiving feedback saying, we can't get into care.
And I guess my main question was, is that information, that metric, being publicly reported so that citizens of a given county, city, et cetera, can go see that?
Yes, and it's not fully transparently reportable in a way that is standardized, which gets to the transparency conversation. So how many people are like math people in this room? I know Jeff is. So when we talk about network adequacy, if we just use a number like 100, and the measure for getting 4 stars for network adequacy as a managed care organization is 90%. So 90 out of a, like, of 100 of your beneficiaries have to be able to get access to timely care, or you have to establish that level of network adequacy. So oftentimes those measures won't establish a denominator. So 90% of what? 90% of everyone that you listed on your network? Or is it 90% of people that picked up the call? Is it 90% of providers that could get you in a timely manner? Is it 90% of people that could get you in within 2 months? And so there's innumerable gaming techniques to make it look like you achieved a 90% network adequacy.
But, you know, one of the recommendations, we're making here is to get better data and get more transparency. But I would also point out that some of the data that they need to get is not just counting widgets, but it's actually hearing from patients and people. I mean, some good qualitative data. You wouldn't know this to look at some of the, like the HEDIS measures or some of the measures that use, until we started hearing from the patients themselves who couldn't get in. Why aren't we using that data? Why aren't we using qualitative data and actually talking to people or listening to what people have to tell us?
Well, and that's the experience that we're having now, is we're sharing this information with everybody. It's not, we're having these conversations with our managed care organizations too. This is a collective effort. But then what's happening with Dr. Melnick's recommendation is they're pointing to their measure and they're like, well, we have an adequate network, right? And so there are whole sub-disciplines of public health, healthcare policy, financing, and public health law experts that can dig into, and there are tools that we can use to essentially scrub what's behind the layer, what's behind the resume, to get to, okay, it's, it looks great on paper, but in practice, I'm gonna go through this list of 100 providers that say that they accept Medicaid, and it turns out, in our use case example, one clinic had space. Right? And so that's just with the one patient that we side-by-sided with on that day and that hour. And so is that enough? Right? So we need more transparency, we need better data, because it would also be unfair to guess what's contributing to the adequacy issue without having all the details.
My understanding is that was it November of this year or last year that we upped the pregnancy Medicaid threshold from 193% to 210%? Mm-hmm. So now like the actual, like more people qualify for Medicaid, and whether or not providers changed their like share of Medicaid patients that you're willing to take, you know, a family of five can make like $87,000 and have
qualify.
And so you've now like expanded to this like larger number of people who maybe underinsured previously and now have access to this. And so
it was a number of years ago that we took the Medicaid expansion. There's still a number of states that don't take Medicaid. We did Washington. That was a number of years ago.
I believe it was either November of 2023 or November of 2024. Expanded pregnancy Medicaid, so we have a larger pool.
Even further.
Yeah.
There was some loss of beneficiaries as well when the automatic enrollment ended as well. So it's to get a sense of but keep in mind, per member per month. So if the total share of the sales go up, the per member per month, like the capitated rate also goes up. They don't have to do more with less, they get more for more.
Mm-hmm. Do they have to establish care with the pregnant person for them to get that headcount?
No.
It's
prepaid.
Prepaid.
That's
like free
per
money.
Member.
They get it.
You're enrolled, they get a payment per month, per member.
whether you ever get seen or not.
And they're only paying the provider that gets seen, so they're actually incentivized financially
to not
have care.
The barrier. And then for more fun on the back end, if you have the unfortunate experience of being a provider, then you submit your reimbursement claim and then they deny it or recategorize it or pay you less for it. And so there are innumerable ways for every participant that has a role in the system of care to experience hardship in doing what matters, which is to provide high quality, timely, preventive care.
Just to be clear too, the commercial payers do the exact same thing. Yes. It's not just Medicaid.
Right.
Okay. But yes, they all do the exact same thing.
Medicaid is just a revenue for a profit source. Yeah. It's and so again, out of four out of the five payers here also have a national mix that includes private pay too. Molina is the outlier in the sense of 80% of their total market share is Medicaid and Medicare, but all of the other plans are big ticket United Elements, the names, and we have those cards. It's the same strategy, it's just a different population.
Yeah, they're all Fortune 500 companies.
100, yeah, and most cases. Yeah.
United is number four. Yeah.
Oh, wait, sorry. Molina's 127, United's 4. Elements is 20. No, Elements is 11.
This is a Fortune 500.
Yeah, I mean, just billions of dollars profit. So what ends up happening, too, with that profit, that it doesn't even stay in our state. So the imperative here, as we experience state and local budget deficits, is we need to be thinking critically about how our money is used and what are we getting for where we put it. And because it's complex by design, it's challenging to kind of get in there and figure out what's happening here. And so I think it really takes a multidisciplinary collective to ensure that we have mechanisms for accountability to make sure we're not paying into a system where we're not getting the very basic components of the plan in theory and in practice. And so some states have had some really great success in still partnering with some of the managed care plans to result in quality and risk and profit sharing. So it's possible, it just takes a ton of work.
I want to thank you, Andrew, for a great presentation.
It just sounds like a lot of gloom and doom, but there's stuff that we can do that I think are some of the recommendations. We're going to be presenting this to the Board of Health tomorrow, so have a discussion.
This might be something that we'll want to think about in the next month, and if you want to bring it back up for more conversation about what we as FAC could do, I think that's maybe listen in at the Board of Health and hear what they have to say, and then maybe think back about what we might be able to do as a group as well. I think, Andrew, you mentioned that earlier. So
there's a phenomenal amount of lived and expert power on this committee to be able to speak to the experiences from varying degrees and perspectives, and we need all of those experiences and perspectives.
Well, I want to also say you did a great job of presenting it. It's really complicated because there is a lot of stuff about this that is unseen. And to the extent possible, the more that we can make it more easy to see, I think that the better off we'll be. But that's not an easy thing to do. I'm well aware of that. But you did a very good job of explaining a very complex issue.
We're trying, I think, but all feedback welcome. I'm especially fascinated to hear about your perspective, and Tracy, your perspective, and Dr. Fisher, and just being behind the curtain on some of those things, or any suggestions you have for making it more consumable.
More money for providers.
Yeah, we're on that. We got that on the list.
Yeah. I mean, it really is a provider, and it's money to be able to pay them. Because the hospitals want people to get prenatal care and all that, because it costs way more money for them to come in without.
And in circumstances where there's no insurance, then you are paying for that as well.
Providers lose money on seeing Medicaid patients.
Oh, yeah.
So this
There, and we need more transparency in the system as well around that, how that's working. And it's good that we have providers here as well as hospitals here, so you can shine a little bit of light on it. From your perspective, it's really helpful.
Well, in my background, if an ICU for 17 years, I saw the results of when prenatal care wasn't available to somebody who really wanted it. So I feel kind of personal about this.
Great conversations. Thank you very much. Give us a lot to think about.
We're not trying to point the finger anymore. We're just trying to figure this out. So.
All right, if there's no more conversation on that topic, I want to move on to talk a little bit about the Board of Health and FAC retreat that occurred in February?
March, yes.
And I'd like to kind of hear from, I was going to call on Michael, and he's not here tonight, so I guess start with Lori, and then if Council Fuentes has anything you want to talk about how you think it went, you know, what were some take-homes. We'll start with Lori, I guess.
I really appreciated it. It was great engagement and a nice opportunity to share and learn. I appreciated with the Board of Health really wanting more information and all asked super thoughtful and insightful questions, and I appreciated the focus on and expressed desire for equity and the real awareness of that. And one of the things that I heard, maybe you're going to speak to, wanting to understand more with the models to find out which, you know, the model that we're in now, or there are other ones across the state, so that we would be seeking more information on that to present to the board. I'm looking at you because you're the only one there. So,
well, anyway. Dr. Lynn was there too. Yeah.
I was there.
Yeah, it's true. You were sitting next to me. No, it was my very first Board of Health meeting, so you know, certainly an appreciation for the work that everybody does and their contributions to this advisory council. It was really informative for me more than anything, and really trying to understand, you know, what Dr. Melnick and his team do for the community here in Clark County. I think my takeaway more than anything is the importance about collaborating, right, and working together, and understanding that, you know, this council has the support. That might have not been the case with other councils, but it certainly is the case now. So you have the support. You know, we care deeply about, you know, the well-being of the community in terms of health. So you know, whatever we can do to continue supporting this council, we'll do that. So, but I enjoy the experience, and the food was good.
That's always important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tracy, you said you were there. I'm sorry, I wasn't there, and so I'm trying.
Yeah, no, I echo what they said. I thought it was very good to hear from the council of what they were looking for from us as a committee, and then there was a lot of dialogue around the structure and having. It seemed like you guys wanted to kind of come together, if possible. It was a lot of things were kind of thrown out about the structure.
I think given the current structure, I heard that you were interested in quarterly meetings of FAC and the Board of Health. I think I heard that.
Think you're correct. I heard the same thing.
So, okay, yeah. So I want to make sure about that. I spoke with the director of our State Association of Local Public Health Officials, and she's happy to come down and meet with both groups, and both FAC and Board of Health, and talk about the alternative structures. I also got a legal opinion, I think I shared this, that you could actually have both at the same time, believe it or not. You could have the expanded Board of Health at the same time you have a FAC. So there's a lot of things to talk about. I don't know that you'd want to do that, given all the input you have here, but that's a conversation we can have. So I also heard today, because I was on a call with WASALFO, our State Association of Public Health Officials, that with the other model, if the elected officials, our counselors, were to add more than their number, so if you were to add, let's say, 10 non-elected members to the Board of Health, you'd have to add another 5 elected members. And given that there's only 5 counselors, you'd have to add 5 other electeds in the county, which could mean people from cities and stuff like that. So that's something else to chew on if you want to expand.
Yeah, I think some of us expressed concern that none of us have a background in healthcare, right? Other than my own personal healthcare, I don't know what's going on out there. I mean, I read articles, obviously, but you know, we're making decisions that you know, impact the health of the community, and sometimes it can get a little political, right? COVID is a really good example, you know. And if you're feeling a certain way, then you know you may not believe in masks or vaccines, and you know, and well, that's a detriment to the health of the community. So we did express concern. I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure we discussed how we might figure out how to overcome. In addition to adding a few more folks.
Did you just say COVID was political?
it was just a little bit, but that is a concern, I think. I mean, I was really shocked when I at my first time on the council, when I learned that we were responsible for making decisions for public health, and so it was a little bit wild. In my personal opinion, I would rather not be a board of health, but. Yeah, I know.
Don't quit.
Yeah, I'm not going anywhere. I mean, I think it's part of the bylaws. I think I have to be part of it. But it just personally, I think it makes sense to have people that actually know what the hell they're doing. So.
But we have. You can see that we have.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like it was a productive, good start on working together, and I think the thought is that we would continue to have. Look at having quarterly meetings, trying to set something up. And as Dr. Melnick said, that there was this representative that was willing to come and talk a little bit more, educate us all about the different models, if that's a conversation that we want to move forward with. So,
I know Whatcom has our model, but they're looking at the other model as well, and they may do both. So, but Jamie Bowden, who's our director of our state association of public health officials, can come down and talk about all that stuff. So,
Dr. Mullin, Clark County is like the second largest FAC, right? It's like King County has a FAC and then Clark County has a FAC, but most counties don't have a FAC.
So the whole statute that changed the structure of local boards of health had the exception for the what's called the Community Health Advisory Board. And when they were writing that statute, it was House Bill 1152 that I remember very well that led to the statute. They actually used FAC as a model for the Community Health Advisory Board. So they used our bylaws here for that. I don't know the size of what Seattle has. So I couldn't answer that. But I know there's several counties that have our model, and Whatcom is one of them. So, but I don't know about the size. Ours is is. You know, 21 members, it's a good size. I'm not answering your question.
I'm just wondering, because I thought that at the softball thing, there's a lot of counties that don't really have a FAC. It was just
correct.
Border town.
Most of them have gone for that other model. That, mm-hmm. But to be able to have a FAC, you had to have it in place before January 1st, 2021. So that statute was passed. Mm-hmm. And counties are only allowed to keep to have this model that we have if they had a FAC. They call it a Community Health Advisory Board in the statute before January, I think it was January 1st, 2021. We've had FAC since 2003. FAC was, yeah, I think I've like gone over the history of that, but we've had a FAC since 2003. And we had a FAC since 2003. Because prior to that, we were not a county health department. We were this was known as the Southwest Washington Health District. It was made up of Klickitat, Skamania, and Clark County. And there were non-elected members and other electeds besides county commissioners on that that structure. When that was dissolved, that was a choice of the county elected officials. And they have decision-making power. They all went their own way and became county health departments. Clark County decided to create the FAC to replace the input that they lost when they were no longer a district. That's a little bit of the history.
So Councilor Fuentes, I think there's a lot of counties that just have like a few counselors that act as a board, and they don't have the support from this group. So don't feel like you're alone in that. I think you'll find out, like many other counties, like...
No, those other counties have to have non-electeds.
Yeah, oh, non-elected, but it's not a fact officially, right?
No, what they'll have is, so if you have 5 elected officials, those counties have to have 5 non-electeds as members. And they could choose, and there's those categories that they can choose from that include some people with health backgrounds, for example.
So we're in slightly better shape. Because of you all.
I don't know, I'm just, you know. We have a pretty unique model.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can disagree.
I love it. I'm biased. I'm trying to keep my bias to myself, which I don't do very well.
All right. Well, to be continued, I think we're going to have some additional kind of group meetings, and I think we're going to be planning another one here shortly.
In a couple of months?
Pardon?
In a couple of months?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So stay tuned. All right, next on the agenda is a membership update, and we do have an educational community member. That's one that we've been looking for months and months, so yay, we have one. She's been approved. And so she'll be joining us at our next meeting. She couldn't come tonight. Jeannie Mills Goodling is her name, and she is an at-risk student advocate at Legacy High School, and works with the at-risk youth facing adversity, and she really has a passion with working with that population. So I think she's going to be a great addition to our FAC, and unfortunately she couldn't be here tonight, but she'll be on our next meeting in May.
So Legacy High School is in the Evergreen School District, and it's an alternative high school, mm-hmm. so she works with that youth risk group. So she's got a great background for this.
Yeah, I think she does too. All right, KDB updates. We'll go around the room, and if anyone has anything that they want to update us about from their organization or the community, we'd love to hear from you. So we'll start at the end.
I don't really have anything.
Nothing? Tracy?
So Peace Health, we received approval for our certificate of need to build a 50-bed inpatient acute rehab with LifePoint. So it should be ready, it should be open at some time in the spring of 27. So, much needed acute inpatient rehab beds. So, we currently only have 14 beds that are always full. So, that was exciting, we just got that. So, it's nice.
I don't have anything.
Quiet group tonight.
Okay, I'm gonna try myself now. Peace Talk, I'm gonna step out of my comfort zone a little more. So thinking of public health, I'm gonna, don't feel like you have to take one, but if you, April Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and so really trying to get the word out for services. If you have a place where you want more of these to set them out, please feel free to contact me or us, we'll get more to you. And again, don't feel like you have to take them, but, some of the stuff that we're doing at the Y anyway with the prevention work, today they kicked off a, for youth, for service providers who work with youth, of a breakfast, so really trying to connect services and support youth by having a more, both collaborative and better to refer. And a lot of people have great services, but if folks don't know about it and they're not connecting youth to those. So if you either work with youth or again, you're like, oh, I know someone who would be great for that, please let me know. I don't know for sure if it's, I believe they're doing it quarterly, but let me know, I'll get the information for you. On housing, so recently the Safe Choice Program received some more funding, specifically it's EPRAP, so in, eviction prevention, something else, I don't know what the rest stands for. But it's to, it, I believe, was not able to be used by some other providers, so through the end of June, and it's specifically for survivors of domestic violence to help pay with past rent or utilities. So it's, you know, again, when you have that little odd resource and being sure to connect folks with us if you're hearing about that. And the last two, next week, they're doing a safe sex kit putting together party to create 500 of them for the community. and just about thinking about, again, public health, people having access to reproductive justice and information, and just, again, also having safe places to talk about this. So if anyone's interested, that is next Tuesday from 6 to 8. And the last thing I'm going to do, and I feel like is probably across the board with nonprofits, but just the funding challenges and the advocacy, which I feel like is not just nonprofits, it's across the board now, but we're seeing, you know, just seeing the impact of that through the Y, and sort of specifically keeping fingers crossed sounds really weak, but not sure what the funding impacts will do as far as with our shelter. We have the only domestic violence shelter for Sterling Clark County. So we're just working and stuff, but we're seeing the impact that I'm sure other people are seeing too. So there.
Yay, thank you, Lori. Great.
You met at the one.
Yeah.
That's where we met. I'll take some more. In addition to this job here, I also work at Fourth Plane Forward, and so right down the street, and we train doulas. I didn't know what they were until just a few months ago, so that's kind of cool. So we do that as well, but I'd like to take some of these to
absolutely.
Yeah, so for Fourth Plane.
Excellent.
So I don't have anything else. That's it.
Okay. Jeff?
Not really a community update, but last Tuesday we kicked off the 2026 budget process with managers. We are still forecasting a pretty significant deficit. It's not usually part of our conversations. The solid waste operations and environmental education program is being moved to Public Works. That increases our deficit by about $400,000. So it's going to be a very difficult budget season. We'll be engaging you next month, I'm sure. That is with House Bill 1152. Not only was it the FAC, it was also defining the role you play as advisors to our budget and our fees. So I'll be bringing that forward next month.
Okay, great. Well, I guess I'd say that I really get a lot out of being part of this group. I'm very grateful that it's structured the way it is. And even though I'm sure it'll evolve over time as needs require that. But anyway, I just want to express that I'm really appreciative of being part of this. I spent about 3 months or more out of the area, and I was worried about how am I going to, you know, get by without having this kind of an opportunity to be working with other people that care about the community that we're in. And I was fortunate to see that the other two places that I'm usually at have similar kinds of situations. Not a FAC per se, but in one community it was raising awareness and also resources for people who are struggling with being unhoused and those kinds of problems. In another case, it was helping at-risk youth. And I guess I'm just here to say that there's a lot of opportunity out there in this community and others. And I don't know, for me, it just gives me energy to be surrounded by people like you all who are working hard to make things better for our community. So thank you.
Well, we're fortunate to have you.
My pleasure.
I have nothing, so I'll move on to Dr.
Oh, a little small update. so on March 21st, it was a Friday evening, I had to make quite a few phone calls to furlough my entire psychiatry team at Columbia River Mental Health Services, and we sent about 120 people home over 48 hours. And things were pretty dire for the agency there for a while, but we actually got a very generous gift from the Cowlitz Tribe Foundation of $1.6 million. Mm-hmm. And it was the largest gift the tribe has made thus far through their foundation, but it was able to rescue our agency. And I brought another psychiatry provider back into the service this week, and I have two more to go on March 5th, but I'm going to have most of that team back, which...
March 5th?
May 5th, which provides provides critical care for bipolar and schizophrenia-afflicted individuals, so it's a big public health win to have that money in, so... Mm-hmm. And I hope, I'm told there's more good news coming down the pike. I don't know what it's going to be, but excited to hear about it.
Tell
you guys all about it next month.
Oh, I don't have it.
We're thrilled.
Yeah.
Yeah. services you provide are so essential. So going along with what I said earlier about spring, I was almost ready to declare the flu season over. Flu season is over when you've got two consecutive weeks where under 10% of tests that are done in, you know, like in the ED and elsewhere are positive. So we're at like 6% this week. Last week we were just a tiny bit under 10%. So we're gonna wait one more week before we declare the, yeah, hopefully it'll stay below 10%, we'll be able to declare the flu season over. I had to throw that in, so my comments about spring.
I don't have any updates, but I'm happy to be here, seeing all of you in person. And I will just give Lori a quick comment about this. I know somebody who received services at the Y, and the impact has been monumental. So thank you for bringing these and stepping outside of your comfort zone to talk about it.
Thank you.
It's a great partnership, and services you provide are essential.
You, as the Environment Public Health Director, I shouldn't let it go by without saying today is Earth Day. So, besides all the public health stuff.
All right. Our next meeting is scheduled for May 27th, but Dr. Melnick is not able to be at that meeting, and so I'd like to know from the others if we can move the meeting to Tuesday the 20th. It would be the week before our normally scheduled meeting. It would be virtual. It's not face-to-face that day.
You're not available on the 20th.
In North Carolina.
But, you know, we could also throw the deputy director under the bus to the central meeting.
First
meeting. Yeah. I'm happy to be here.
Anybody else?
So, are we rescheduling next month?
Well, I think we're going to take it under advisement and then we'll let you know.
Okay.
So, but if the 20th works for you, then we'll know that that works if we need to move it.
Works for me. I'm the first one.
You have the 27th also. So
the 27th.
Is that the memorial weekend?
Yeah.
So it might work better to do it on the 20th just because people will be out for the long weekend.
Oh,
so.
People are out anyway.
Yeah.
There's no council meeting on the 20th, is there, Jeff?
I don't know. I don't have my council phone.
I should ask you.
Third Tuesday.
Oh,
it's the third Tuesday.
Is it the third Tuesday? Yes,
the 20th is the third Tuesday.
Is it the third Tuesday that you meet in the evening?
Let's. Absolutely, yeah, I think it's next week. I don't know. I know what. I can check here. I do have my phone.
So then,
I just show up.
Yeah, we'll double check. We'll double check that and make sure. Because I get confused.
The council meeting is on your calendar for the 20th.
Yeah, but that's an old calendar thing.
It's on my calendar.
I think you got it from me. So we'll double check.
Well, the executive committee will meet and decide, but at least we know that the 20th would work if we need to do that. And we'll let you know as soon as that decision is made. So.
Actually, Tuesday is council.
Yeah. The 20th.
Yeah, the 20th.
Uh-huh. In the evening?
6 p.m., yeah.
Okay, well, that leaves that out then. Okay.
So I guess we're leaving it on the 27th. And we'll find a substitute for Dr. Melnick.
That's easy to find.
We'll probably have a budget.
Okay.
It's a virtual meeting, right?
It is a virtual
meeting. So my wife's having surgery that day, and I'm taking care of her. I may be able to get on anyway. So.
Okay. All right. That's well, we're going to leave it on the 27th as it stands now. Sorry, I confused everybody. And unless there's anything else for you to cause, we'll adjourn the meeting till May 27th. Thank you. Have a great spring.